From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and we start a new month today, Tanya, and hopefully May won't be as bad as April. But one thing is clear, which is that different states are starting off the month with very different strategies to reopen after weeks of coronavirus shutdowns.
Yeah, that's right. Yes, here in California, there's a four-stage plan to reopen the state over the next several months. And the governor is keeping beaches in Orange County closed this weekend. That's where we've been seeing those images of large crowds gathering.
And meanwhile, in Georgia, the stay-at-home order has been lifted, except for people over 65 or with health problems. And nearly all businesses will have a green light to open today in Texas, even though that state has not met voluntary federal guidelines. And President Trump is set to resume travel next week. He says maybe he'll wear a mask. Let's bring in Beth Fooey, senior politics editor for NBC and MSNBC. Hi, Beth.
Hey, Jeremy.
And President Trump plans to visit a mask-making factory in Arizona on Tuesday. He cut back on his press briefings this week, although yesterday he was asked if he'd lead a moment of mourning for the country. Here's what he said.
Nobody's thinking about it more. Nobody has spent more time late in the evening thinking about what's happened to this country in a short period of time. But at the same time, we have to get our country open again. And we're doing that step by step.
Beth, did you see a shift this week in how the White House is handling the virus?
Well, you definitely saw a shift away from those 5 o'clock, 5:30 p.m. evening briefings that would typically go on at times as long as 2 hours, with the president just sort of holding forth from the podium and really kind of dominating the conversation and pushing his health experts and other advisors off to the side. And clearly the decision was made at the White House that this was not serving the president well. Our reporting has found that he has been presented with polling evidence that showed that his numbers started to go down as these weeks of briefings wore on, that he was losing support in key battleground states and among key demographics, particularly older voters who basically have been his strongest supporters. So there was a decision made that he needed to shift course a bit. So he's certainly been speaking to reporters this week, just in different settings, in different formats. He's going off to Camp David tonight at 5 o'clock rather than brief the press at 5. So it's clear that the White House is trying a different tack on messaging here.
Meanwhile, there is other news today, which is that this morning, for the first time, presumptive Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden addressed a sexual assault allegation from 1993 raised by a former Senate staffer of his named Tara Reid. And on MSNBC's Morning, Joe Biden was asked about his support for a woman who accused then Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh of sexual assault and whether women are to be believed in the Me Too era. Here it is.
Look, women are to be believed given the benefit of the doubt. If they come forward and say something that they said happened to them, they should start off with the presumption they're telling the truth. Then you have to look at the circumstances and the facts. And the facts in this case do not exist. They never happened.
Biden's been under pressure to speak. What did you make of what he said today?
Yeah, he really needed to come out and make a statement because the allegation that sort of started a little bit on the fringe early on had definitely gained mainstream traction, particularly after Tara Reid, several of the people that she said she had spoken to about the allegation at the time started to come forward and say that they did recall having conversations with her. It's still a little bit murky. We've reached out and spoken to many people who Tara Reid said had knowledge of this allegation, and we're getting stories that don't completely tell the story of what she said happened to her. So we're continuing to do the reporting necessary to get to the bottom of this if we can. What I would say, though, is that Biden did need to come out and make a statement. He's stayed silent while a number of people in his orbit, particularly some of the women who are probably on his short list to be his number two as vice president, have been asked about it. So suddenly you had Elizabeth Warren being asked. You had Amy Klobuchar being asked. You had Kirsten Gillibrand, another senator who's been very outspoken on Me Too issues, being asked, all of them saying that they support the vice president. But there was no reason for this to be on their shoulders to make the case for him. He really needed to come out and make the case for himself.
And there are going to be questions now about whether he should release Senate records from the University of Delaware. We'll follow that. And of course, we should note that President Trump has been accused of rape, sexual assault, and sexual harassment by more than a dozen women. So there'll be questions about whether he is going to have to answer for himself on those allegations. Again, Beth Fooey, senior politics editor for NBC and MSNBC. Thanks as always.
Thank you.
The biotech company Moderna said today that it will work with a Swiss company to accelerate the production of a potential coronavirus vaccine. Researchers don't know yet if it's effective, but the vaccine is currently in federally funded human trials in Washington state. Neil Browning lives just outside of Seattle, and he's taking part in this trial. He received his first shot in March and the second last month, and he joins us now. Welcome, Neil.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Neil, a little bit about you. We read that you have two children. You're 46 years old, a software engineer. What made you decide to volunteer for this trial?
So I grew up, my mother was a registered nurse, and I've always been interested in science and medicine. So when this opportunity presented itself, I did my own little bit of research and felt like the risks were minimal compared to what benefits the entire world could reap from people stepping forward and taking part in this trial.
At the same time, there have been concerns that this vaccine has not been proven safe. In fact, the company Moderna, which is about 10 years old, has not brought a single product to market. It uses a new technology with still a lot of questions. Are you concerned about the risks?
I spoke with the research doctors at Kaiser Permanente, who's running the trial for Moderna through the NIH funding here in Washington state. And they said that, you know, there's obviously going to be some risks because this was never trialed previously on animals before going straight to humans in order to speed the process. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of unknowns. As you said, this is definitely something brand new. There is no dead, weakened virus in this vaccine. So The risk of actually contracting anything from the vaccine is minimal, though it is new research using messenger RNA to reprogram DNA in my cellular structure of my body. I guess the worst possible things that they described could be an adverse reaction to just being vaccinated myself, if I'd ever had any issues in the past, which I have not, and headaches, possible slight fever, congestion, and possibly nausea.
Restructuring your cellular data in your body. That sounds very complex. Can you explain a little bit more about what you've been told about how this will work and really coming to a possible vaccine?
Sure. So the way that Moderna's RNA technology works is that it goes into the human cell and it encourages our cells to rebuild themselves with the spike protein structure that is prevalent on the outside of the coronavirus cell. So the idea is if we can get cells within our body to create those exact proteins, and it looks like something that shouldn't be there, our white blood cells and immune system should react to it as if it were a virus and learn how to build antibodies that match those protein spikes without actually being infected with COVID-19.
How have you been feeling? You mentioned that nausea and congestion might be potential side effects.
So they sent everyone home after their first injection and their second injection with an 8-day memory journal where we were to document any and all issues that we encountered that were out of the norm. The only thing that I had either time was much like if you'd received an injection for the flu shot, where my arm at the site of the injection was very slightly sore the next morning. Within 30 minutes of waking up and moving around, that soreness went away.
What do you have coming up now? Any more doses? How long will you be monitored? Those types of things.
I had the initial injection of 25 micrograms, as you mentioned, back in mid-March. And then 4 weeks later, I had the second dose as a booster. Now I'm in a hold and wait mode where I will go in sporadically over the next year and they will do blood draws to see how my body's reacting to the vaccine and hopefully see that antibodies are created and that those antibodies stay in the bloodstream for about a year's time, which is the hallmark of a pretty successful vaccine.
What does your family think about you taking part in this trial?
My fiance is a registered nurse, so she and I discussed any of the issues, and she felt like this was safe enough to do and that definitely humankind can benefit from a vaccine. So the more people that try and help out and end this pandemic, the sooner, the better we are. My daughters didn't really know much about what was going on until I pretty much had been getting ready to get in the car and go down and have this done. Now that things have kind of exploded all over the news, and since the injections, states have been in lockdown and they've seen all the impact around the world, they're pretty awestruck by the enormity of what's happening to the world and that their dad is somebody who's helping try and end this with a good donation of his body to science.
That's Neil Browning. He's taking part in a trial in Washington State for a potential coronavirus vaccine. Neil, thank you so much for taking the time with us.
Not a problem. Thank you for having me on.
Coronavirus testing, as we've been hearing, is considered a major requirement on the path to safely end stay-at-home orders. And President Trump says that responsibility belongs to the states. But while many states are actually struggling to ramp up their testing capacity, two states in the West are showing promise. Ray Allen Bushell from the Mountain West News Bureau reports.
Ashish Jha is the director of the Harvard Global Health Institute, and he says there are strong signs that two states in the western part of the country are doing a good amount of testing relative to the size of their states and their outbreaks.
I think what Utah and New Mexico show us is that clearly this is doable. Like the people who think, oh, testing is too hard, can't do it. No, you can do it. And they've done it.
The rest of the region, though.
Colorado and others need to get their act together and move forward on this, especially as they begin to think about opening up.
Turns out there are at least two differences about New Mexico and Utah that could be playing a part. Number one, testing czars. In mid-March, New Mexico and Utah appointed people whose entire job was to figure out how to ramp up testing, coordinating not just with public labs, but also commercial ones. In New Mexico, that role is filled by Dr. Stephen Jennison.
I'm a retired physician, infectious diseases specialist.
And he has a long history of working with viruses. Now, all he thinks about is expanding New Mexico's COVID-19 testing.
About 16 hours a day. This is my job.
Jennison learned that two big healthcare systems seem to have a good handle on testing in urban areas. So Jennison and his colleagues focused energy on rural areas. Now,
on any given day, there are between 50 and 60 testing sites.
At the same time, Utah's testing czar Nate Checkitz was identifying the bottlenecks keeping labs in that state from testing more. Early on, they were short on the key chemicals needed for the tests. So Checkitz says they launched a statewide search.
And we found them everywhere.
For example, he says a manufacturer found a box of 750 test kits just lying around and donated them to the state. Checkitz also set up a regular conference call with all the local laboratories.
Every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday in the evening, we get together for an hour and run through these issues.
He says the labs have been trading tips, like leads on where to get supplies, even at times sharing materials. The second thing that stands out about Utah and New Mexico is their laboratories. Many states have tended to rely largely on their public health labs and two national companies, LabCorp and Quest. But in Utah and New Mexico, local commercial labs have done the lion's share of testing, doing about half of all COVID-19 tests or more. In Utah, that's ARUP Laboratories. Dr. Julio Delgado is the chief medical officer, and he says they were already prepared to some extent for viral epidemics, like Zika virus.
So we had all the instrumentation that normally is used for those type of pandemic situations, and then we were able to quickly deploy them for this type of testing.
Initially, ARUP was accepting samples from patients across the country, but Delgado says they quickly got swamped, so they had to make a difficult decision. To stop accepting samples from so many places.
That was probably the five most difficult days of my life as a professional.
In the end, they decided to focus primarily on testing in Utah. In New Mexico, TriCor Reference Laboratories has played a similar role. Dr. Douglas Clark is the chief medical officer. He says, like ARUP, they already had a lot of the diagnostic testing equipment.
We didn't have to purchase the instrumentation, bring it in, get it validated. It was already here.
Clark says it also helped that TriCor has a big footprint across the state, working with a bunch of healthcare sites, including 15 hospitals.
That really allowed us to have access to large number of patients as soon as the pandemic began here in New Mexico.
New Mexico and Utah's relative testing successes weren't flukes, according to their testing czars. Stephen Jennison says in New Mexico, Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham took testing seriously right from the beginning.
I believed that this governor was doing the right things and doing them early.
Utah's Nate Checkett says leadership in his state prioritized it, too.
It's a core part of every state strategy, but we've really leaned heavily into that as trying to find a way forward through this crisis.
A partnership with a local tech nonprofit recently boosted testing numbers there even further. According to an analysis by STAT and the Harvard Global Health Institute, both states have enough testing capacity to be prepared to reopen starting this month. For Here and Now, I'm Ray Ellen Bichelle.
And we now know that COVID-19 is disproportionately impacting Black Americans who are getting sick and dying at higher rates than other populations. Scholars have been thinking about how survival elements used in the past, like the creation of new forms of music and art, can serve as a form of comfort and healing. This concept is often called Afrofuturism, and it's more than science fiction. For more, we have Alondra Nelson from Princeton University. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
So back in the 1990s, cultural critic Mark Deary coined this term Afrofuturism after listening to conversations led by you and others. And over the years, it's kind of been described as this way of being that Black people can kind of take back the trauma of the past by reimagining it, while also reimagining or imagining our futures and building those futures. How do you define it, especially right now in the time of this pandemic?
I think right now, you know, Afrofuturism as a kind of form of ingenuity across Black history is an important reminder for us that there have been times when innovation and ingenuity were really required in life, that there were times, other times, when people really struck out and thought anew about what the future should be and might be. And so, as you know, so many are talking about reopenings and reimaginings of what the social space might be. It's a pretty important kind of intellectual and creative genealogy to look back to and to look forward with.
And some of those moments of ingenuity as a means for survival were through the arts. So we're talking jazz, gospel music, dance. And, you know, there's been this resurgence of the study and imagination of Afrofuturism over the last few years. A good example of this is the movie Black Panther, which imagined a world like Wakanda where white supremacy doesn't exist. What are some examples in science or music that exemplifies this idea?
Yes, there's so much to say there. I mean, I think if we think of the, you know, an Afrofuturist tradition that comes out of the space of music, there are lots of examples from jazz, but also from other, you know, from pop music and from R&B, in which, you know, people were really being quite innovative with form and actually, in some instances, being accused of using technology in the wrong way. So two examples that come to mind are the Jamaican dub producer Lee Scratch Perry, and also probably more widely known to your listeners would be George Clinton, who who we know from Parliament and Funkadelic. Yes. And, you know, he tells a story in interviews and conversation about having at one time, you know, on some occasions been in a recording studio in which he was asking the engineers to sort of do things with different frequencies and lower frequencies of music. And, you know, basically being told you're doing it wrong. And then sort of saying, you know, get out of here, I'll figure it out myself, and kind of going to the dials and going to the table. And so, you know, the doing it wrong actually kind of has led to profound kind of innovation in the creation of funk music and the extension of African Americans' contributions to rock and roll, which comes out of Black culture significantly.
Yeah, you know, some scholars have argued that this moment in time, this pandemic, is kind of like a portal that's ushering us into a new world. And there is this possibility of creating new and better ways of being with each other, as well as the creation of new arts. That to me is a very Afrofuturist sensibility. Are you seeing this?
Well, I think certainly in the realm of imagination and symbolic space, you're seeing the portal metaphor played out. There's already a great deal of, you know, new music and new art being born out of this moment all over the world as people try to reckon with it and make sense of it. There's an interesting hip-hop artist from the UK called Sykes, P-S-Y-C-H-S, which I think very early on in the pandemic, you know, does a video, with his posse, and is, you know, they're wearing masks and they're wearing gloves and they're navigating on how to engage with each other in public space and not shake hands and do other things. And so, you know, there's the music itself, and then there's the video of the work, which is, people, you know, kind of figuring out a new way to be together when we are living in a world with, you know, a virus.
You know, thinking about the moment that we're in right now and the role that Afrofuturism might have in creating a post-pandemic society, what are your thoughts, your parting words?
I think, you know, it's important to remember that the Afrofuturist tradition in arts and letters and music is really writing with and up against the possibility of Black annihilation, you know, the sort of possibility that the world could end, but that there were always sort of spaces of possibility. And so I would want us to remember that the most marginalized and the most vulnerable communities, time and time again, over generations, over hundreds of years, have created beauty and resilience and life again and again. And so, you know, that's a gift that Black culture has brought to the world again and again that I think certainly should be appreciated and embraced in this moment, and done in such a way that people, many people who are the essential workers who are African Americans, should not be left to suffer.
Alondra Nelson, professor in the School of Social Science at the Institute for Advanced Study at Princeton University. Thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure to be with you, Tanya.
Let's check in on France, where more than 24,000 people have died from COVID-19. It's one of the worst hit countries in the world. But health officials there say they have been able to keep hospitals in Paris from becoming completely overwhelmed, thanks in part to an app that helps non-critical patients ride out the virus at home. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports.
On a weekend in mid-March, just before the coronavirus wave hit France, 32-year-old Daphne Rousseau was outside of Paris enjoying a lunch in the countryside with friends.
Suddenly after lunch, I started to feel a bit weird. But then after a few hours, it was obvious that something was going wrong, because I had for the first time in my life a shortness of breath, which is a very, very unusual thing to feel when you never had asthma or any problem with your lungs.
That night, Rousseau had to prop herself up in bed to breathe.
I felt very dizzy. I felt that my lungs were doing half of the job, like only half of what should go inside my lungs was actually going through my lungs.
She called the emergency hotline, but it took 49 minutes to get through. A doctor eventually came to Rousseau's apartment. He examined her and diagnosed COVID without doing a blood test.
And then he left.
The doctor told Rousseau she would receive a text allowing her to sign into an app that would guide her through the virus. COVIDOM, which stands for COVID and domicile, helps monitor COVID patients at home. Cardiologist Patrick Jourdain runs the platform.
This app was developed with the goal of keeping people with non-critical cases from blocking up the paramedics, emergency rooms, and hospitals.
Rousseau answered daily questions generated by the app on her breathing, heart rate, temperature, and a host of other parameters.
You turn yourself into a little doctor every day, and they are adding, like, sometimes new questions because they were, I think, getting more information about new symptoms.
After crunching her information, the Covidome app sent Rousseau color-coded messages.
And there is 3 levels of alerts. Green, everything is okay. Orange, moderate, you will be called by a doctor when someone is available. And red, you're being called within 8 minutes by the emergency line.
This video shows some of the 2,000 volunteers, mostly medical students and non-essential healthcare workers, who've been trained to man the platform and work the phones. After her nearly 3-week ordeal, Daphne Rousseau is now fine. She says the coronavirus is a roller coaster, both physically and psychologically, but at least having the app meant that she didn't feel alone.
And you know yourself that there are some days that will be good, but it doesn't mean you're at the end of the disease, that it's done. I was having this amazing monitoring, but it was all virtual. Nobody touched me. I was talking to a camera, to some doctor that I've never seen in my life. And you go through the disease like this.
Covidome's Dr. Jourdain says the app has helped keep 53,000 patients in the Paris region at home and reduce the strain on the city's hospitals. Only 300 app users have needed hospitalization, he says, and they were identified before their condition became critical. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Paris.
Well, another story we are following today. After months of quarantine, people in China are hungry for travel. Today is the start of a long weekend there, and airline bookings were reportedly 15 times higher than recent levels. Here in the United States, airlines are now requiring travelers to wear masks. But finding a flight to your destination could be trickier. For example, there is only one direct flight tomorrow from New York to San Francisco, one of the most profitable routes in America. April is a month the auto industry is going to want to forget. The industry is likely to see its lowest sales since records began in 1976. Stay-at-home orders have shuttered car dealerships in many parts of the country since March. And joining us now is Michelle Krebs, who's an executive analyst for Cox Automotive in Detroit. Hi, Michelle.
Hi.
So first of all, who is buying cars right now?
Well, an assortment of people, because despite how low car sales are, there are still buyers. First of all, there are always those buyers that absolutely need a car. And that's people, you know, that may have a breakdown or an accident. People who are doing deliveries, and there are a lot of deliveries these days. So we're seeing strong sales for delivery vans, for example, and pickup trucks. People are buying pickup trucks. And part of it is because we're seeing people who are very attracted to the 0% 84-month deals that are out there.
And are there a lot of those? If you want to buy a car right now, you can get 0% interest for 80 months?
You can get 0% 84 months from mostly the domestic manufacturers, so from General Motors, Ford, Fiat Chrysler. Toyota's got it on a couple vehicles. There are a few others. It was the domestics that really kicked it into gear right after the COVID-19 was declared a global pandemic.
And that's just because they've got to get the cars off the lot or what?
This was a trick they'd learned from the Great Recession. People really are attracted to 0% financing. Yes, they want to keep their dealers in business. They want to keep sales going. Right now, they're not running their plants, so they're trying to keep dealers in business.
And in terms of the dealerships themselves, many of them are closed. Is it possible to even test drive a car right now?
There are some states that dealerships are allowed to stay open. But what we are seeing is something that consumers have wanted for a long time, to do the deal online and have the dealer deliver the vehicle to them for the test drive or ultimately to do the purchase. So we're seeing a lot of that. In fact, consumers are very much favoring vehicles that they can buy mostly online.
Well, and the last time that I went online in search of a car, I have to say that it wasn't that easy. The websites are not as easy as like going on and buying, a new shirt or something like that. Is the online car market up to date and ready to handle this influx?
Well, there have been dealers doing it for some time, and everybody's been moving in that direction. This crisis just speeded it up. And when we do consumer surveys, that's exactly what they tell us they want. So we're not going back, I can tell you that.
And what about inventory? What is the impact of plants closing down all over the world due to the coronavirus?
Well, plants all over the world are pretty much closed. They started opening in China and Europe, and we will be starting those up here in North America over the next month. When this all started, there was a pretty good amount of inventory on the ground. But as sales increase, as we think they will, there could be some shortages going forward because the plants are going to take a little while to get up to speed.
Do you think, Michelle Krebs, that April is going to be the bottom, or do you expect the drop in vehicle sales will continue, especially with the other economic conditions, including that so many Americans are now without a job?
We actually think April will be the bottom. We think this will be a historically low month, but we're already seeing signs through our shopping data on like Kelley Blue Book and Auto Trader that it's bottoming out and people are actually back on shopping again and looking to buy. So I would expect in May we'll see improvement and continue that improvement through the summer.
I want to ask you one more thing because for those of us who already have a car, I was reading on Twitter from a colleague who said that she hadn't used her car in a while because, of course, so many people are working from home. And she went in to turn it on and there were rats building nests and engines. Well, I guess the auto mechanic said that he had gotten a number of calls like that recently. What's your advice to people who have cars and maybe they're not using them very much right now?
Well, my sister actually had a bird build a nest on her rear tire. So, yes, I think the advice is go out for a little spin. You don't want your battery to die, so rev it up and take a little drive. And also, if you let it sit a long time, the brakes can rust. So go for a little drive.
That is Michelle Krebs, who is executive analyst for Cox Automotive in Detroit. Michelle, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, today is May Day, and essential workers around the country are protesting what they call unsafe working conditions during the pandemic. Of course, they are leveraging social media to get the word out. So let's get to our weekly social media roundup with Femi Oke, host of the stream on Al Jazeera English. Hi, Femi.
Hello there, Jeremy.
So workers at Amazon, Whole Foods, Target, FedEx, and more are among those calling in sick or walking off the job today. What are you seeing on social media about this?
Some very high-profile influencers supporting the workers. So, for instance, in the last few hours, Senator Bernie Sanders has tweeted, May Day 2020, I stand with the workers at Amazon, Whole Foods, Instacart, Target, who are on strike. He talks about essential workers. Naomi Klein, again, another high-profile influencer, talks about employers treat them as disposable. These essential workers are on strike. So a lot of support. And also because there aren't that many protests that are happening actually out and about. So there are a lot of comments revisiting old May Day parades and remembering why it is that May Day is so important for workers around the world.
And what are some of these big companies saying in response?
Oh, they are ready. They're ready for the critique. So, for instance, Whole Foods has posted that we really look after our workers. In fact, a lot of the ideas for safety for our workers, that comes from the workforce itself. Whole Foods says this is what we're doing to take care of our workers. So right there on social, where the protests are happening, that is also where these big companies are also saying, hey, well, hold on a minute, we are looking after our workers.
Others are rallying to demand an end to stay-at-home orders. We saw this in Michigan yesterday with the armed protesters at the state capitol. You're seeing conversations heating up online about this. What are the protesters and their supporters saying, first of all?
Well, the protesters are saying that something has to give. It is important that we get back to work. We are really struggling. It is our right to be allowed out of our homes and to be able to go back to work. On the other side of that debate, people saw the pictures of the protests in Michigan and they called them domestic terrorists. They said, why are you carrying a gun? Why do you need to carry guns? And if there were any other group or minority group of people who went out and protested with guns, they would be in trouble. So drawing a comparison to the, here's one of the hashtags, white privilege, as social is calling some of these Michigan protesters.
And that is a debate that I'm sure is going to continue to heat up, not just in Michigan, but other areas as well as this goes on. Meanwhile, Femi, because it is Friday and you mm-hmm. always like to bring a smile to our face, I want to ask you about something a little more fun, which is all these people are working from home and we're seeing them on TV and we're seeing what the house looks like. We're seeing what their background looks like. And now there's a Twitter account called Room Raider that is judging people's living rooms, kitchens, and home offices.
So much judgment, Jeremy.
How does this work?
All right. So you have to go and look at this, everybody. Rate my Skype room on Twitter. And you are marked out of 10 for things like composition, art, depth, books, lamp. Is your lamp turned on? Is your hair combed? What does your art look like? It is so much fun and it is not entirely serious. So for instance, Elmo was rated because Elmo was on CNN last weekend and Elmo got a 9 out of 10. Elmo was like, I love that. I love your colors. I love your background. Pete Buttigieg, Pete on the dangers of cutting one's own hair. His hair didn't look the best. He got a 4 out of 10. And poor old Beto O'Rourke, he got 0. And it was organizing rescue mission. Blink twice if you can hear me. This is so much fun because it's doing basically, Jeremy, what you and I, and we're all doing is we're kind of peeking around the guest or peeking around the host just to mm-hmm. see what their houses actually look like. The team behind it are a partner team, and it's Jesse Bari and also Claude Taylor. And they are partisan, and they are very liberal. And so they make a lot of fun of anybody who they either roast or compliment, but people are loving it and even trying to submit their Skype setups to see what kind of number that they will get.
I had no idea that so many people had built-in bookcases, but it seems like everybody does behind them in their Skype shot. Femi Okeh, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. Thanks as always.
You're so welcome.
Minnesota is one of at least 6 states extending its stay-at-home orders because of the coronavirus. Governor Tim Walz made the decision yesterday. Walz has already decided to close schools for the rest of the academic year, but he's given the green light for some non-essential businesses, like industrial workplaces, to begin opening if they follow a set of safety guidelines. One Minnesota manufacturer is getting ready to reopen this Monday. Bob Riggleman is president of Rydell Skates in Red Wing, Minnesota. He had to furlough around 70 of his 100 workers and received a 7-figure federal emergency relief loan. Bob, welcome to Here and Now.
Well, thank you very much.
First of all, how's it going? How has the coronavirus shutdown impacted your business? Your company makes skates of all kinds for consumers, all the way to the top pros.
Yeah, being a manufacturer and being shut down for 5 weeks is difficult. And the fact that manufacturers, you know, need to make what they sell. And if they're not able to make product, you know, they're not able to sell anything. So the last 5 weeks have been trying, to say the best.
For your workers, what are you doing to protect them when they do come back? Will they wear masks?
Yeah, well, we've spent a lot of time in the last week putting together our COVID-19 preparedness plan for our company at Rydell. We will have PPE equipment available, both from a mask perspective, face shield perspective, and glove perspective. And we're leaving it non-mandatory, up to the employees to choose if they want to wear them or not.
Are you worried, though, if there are workers with underlying health conditions? What have you told your workers about that?
Well, first and foremost, let me explain that every day when they report to work to get into the building, they get their temperature taken and a health assessment questionnaire taken every day. And if their temperature registers over 100.4, then they are turned away and told to go home and if need be, seek medical attention, and they're not able to return to work until their temperature is under 100.4 for 24 hours without the use of any medication. So we're trying to do the screening the best we possibly can before the workers even start on their shift.
You know, we have learned all too well how hard this has been, not only on businesses, but individuals, employees. What are you hearing from your workers coming back to work, for instance, because schools are also closed. So many families are having to navigate all of this at the same time.
Yeah, surprisingly, for the most part, I would say they're all pretty excited to come back to work. A lot of them seem to be, I hate to use this terminology, but the stay-at-home order, you know, starting to get bored with what's going on, and they're looking to kind of get their life back in order.
We know that Republicans in Congress want to pass a bill shielding businesses from liability if anyone becomes sick because a business is reopened. The National Association of Manufacturers supports this kind of expanded liability relief. What if a worker becomes sick at your establishment? Do you have any concerns there?
Well, if a worker would be tested positive or become sick with COVID-19, we would immediately get that worker to the doctor, number one. And number two, we would then trace back to who that worker has been in contact with and have those people tested immediately. And we would probably shut our workforce down into a complete decontamination and disinfecting for about 72 hours. And then once that's done, we would leave the building, sit empty for 72 hours before we resumed.
I've been talking with business owners and they're saying, like, this is a new normal for us.
Oh.
We are now re-examining our businesses and the way that we're operating and running our businesses. And it sounds like you guys have spent a lot of time on protocol. This might be the way it is.
Yeah, you know, you're exactly right. I think the new normal changes daily, to be honest with you. You know, we've encouraged our employees as we've talked to them this week about coming back next week. Number one, when they come back, if they see or realize something that we as a company could be doing better to keep our employees safe, or I should say more safe than we think they are now, please bring that to our attention so that we can at least look at it with an open mind and an open ear and see if we can't try to accommodate that. But I think the new normal, we don't know what it is. I think it's going to be changing daily for some time.
That's Bob Riggleman, president of Rydell Skates in Red Wing, Minnesota. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.